somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 34, The Age of Reaction, The Fall and Rise of Free Speech in 19th Century Europe.
The freedom of the press is to the 19th century what spiritual freedom was to the Christian of the first century and religious freedom to the 16th and 17th centuries. It is the political question of life and death in our time, the question that wrecks governments and reduces kingdoms to death or gives them the strength to rise. The fight for the freedom of the press is a holy war, the holy war of the 19th century.
This dramatic proclamation was written by the mid-19th century German parliamentarian Georg von Bunsen. It might seem a surprising pronouncement given the immense victories that proponents of free speech had secured in the 18th century with the First Amendment and the French Declaration of the Rights of Man as the crown and scepter. But as we saw in episode 31, the 18th century ended with free speech in full retreat. With the French Revolution, the call for enlightenment now was no longer seen as the harbinger of humanity's inevitable march towards progress. It had become to many synonymous with radical forces of destruction, drowning monarchy, tradition and religion in the blood of kings, aristocrats and nuns. With the defeat of Napoleon in 1814, conservatives and monarchs were firmly back in power, and they had no intention of letting go. Never again were those rulers who had put down wild-eyed revolutionaries like mad dogs going to allow radicals to seduce the people with lofty principles and propaganda. In order to rebuild a stable Europe with respect for authority and tradition, freedom of speech had to be reined in. And Europe's new conservative order was soon up at the Congress of Vienna from 1814 to 15. In this whirlwind episode, we'll see what that meant for freedom of speech in the following century. So buckle up, because we'll be covering a lot of ground. As we saw in the last regular episode, the government of William Pitt managed to suffocate any revolutionary tendencies in Britain with a raft of repressive laws and proclamations that limited freedom of the press and association. Most importantly, Pitt had succeeded in exiling Tom Paine, the foremost prophet of sedition. But the early 19th century would not bring reprieve for Britons demanding fair political representation or decent working conditions. And most certainly not for Paineite politics being spread in the new penny press, which made radical ideas cheaply available to the masses. In fact, Tory governments would use the matrix molded by Pitt to clamp down on radical speech and action all through the 1810s and 20s. The most trusted tool of the government was the good old law of seditious libel. More than 100 informations and indictments for seditious and blasphemous libel were brought before the King's Bench Court alone in the late teens and early 20s. Substantially more than even during the Napoleonic Wars. Most prosecutions were aimed at publishers and printers rather than writers, much like governments today aim at the choke point of social media platforms rather than the individual users. But the law of seditious libel was not always as effective a weapon as the government would have liked. Since 1792, the role of juries had been strengthened, and they were not always the government's stooges, even though they were often cherry-picked, with a biased judge presiding. On average, trials resulted in convictions and time served only in 38% of the cases brought before the King's Bench in the critical years from 1817 to 1822. Prosecuting satire could prove especially embarrassing for the government, since the offending material had to be read aloud in court. Especially disastrous was the 1817 trial against the satirist William Hone, who poked fun of Christian Litany and the government. At the very beginning of the trial, the Attorney General began reading from Hone's John Wilkes Catechism, in which a certain Lick Spittle is asked to rehearse his articles of belief.
I believe in George, the Regent Almighty, maker of new streets and knights of the Bath, and in the present ministry, his only choice, who were conceived of Toryism, brought forth of William Pitt, suffered loss of place under Charles James Fox, were execrated, dead and buried. In a few months they rose again from their minority, they reascended to the treasury benches, and sit at the right hand of a little man with a large wig, from whence they laugh at the petitions of the people who pray for reform.
Immediately, the whole courtroom burst into laughter, leaving the Attorney General humiliated and his case looking petty and ridiculous. But the relatively low rate of convictions does not tell the whole story, because the most pernicious effect of seditious libel proceedings was the extreme degree of legal uncertainty, opaque procedure, and financial distress suffered by those prosecuted. The government could prosecute libelers using administrative informations that avoided grand juries. And there was no way of knowing where precisely the red lines were drawn. One person could be acquitted for writing something critical of the government, and another person convicted for republishing those very words. And the government could change the time and place of the trial at will. Defendants had to pay all costs themselves, even if they were acquitted, and could sometimes spend up to a year in prison before the trial if they couldn't post surety. They would also stay behind bars after time served if they couldn't pay for steep fines and costs. This took its toll on the physical and mental health, not to mention the finances, of those targeted, and made many others think twice about publishing controversial stuff at all. But the public sphere is not limited to writings, and as we'll see, one of the most famous battles for freedom of expression in 19th century Britain did not take place in the print shops, but on the streets of Manchester. After the Battle of Waterloo, the British Empire was now clearly the most powerful state in the world, through a combination of industrialization and naval power. Britannia not only ruled the waves, but a substantial part of the land as well. But the end of the Napoleonic Wars did not signal the beginning of a happy and peaceful time for the British people. An economic and social crisis, known as the post-war slump, struck hard with massive unemployment and lower wages as a result. And nowhere was this felt more than in the new industrial powerhouse and textile hub of Manchester. In the 50 years before the crisis, Manchester had grown from a small town of 24,000 to more than 100,000 people. The desperate poverty of Mancunians was captured in an account from the Times.
The streets are confined and dirty, the houses neglected, and the windows often without glass. Out of the windows the miserable rags of the family hung up to dry. The household furniture, the bedding, the clothes of the children, and the husband were seen at the pawnbroker's.
But the people of Manchester did not just suffer in silence. During the early 19th century, repeated rioting took place, including the Luddite uprisings of 1813-16, where workers smashed the machines they felt were stealing their jobs. But good old-fashioned rioting was gradually replaced by a new form of political expression, public meetings. This deeply worried the government. In 1817, the government of Lord Liverpool revived Pitt's gagging acts and suspended habeas corpus, ordered a new crackdown on seditious libel, and banned unlicensed public meetings of more than 50 people. But when the gagging acts expired again in 1818, at least 16 public meetings were held in Manchester pushing for political reform. Initially, the goal was a minimum wage and affordable bread. But when the government ignored anti-austerity petitions, the workers concluded that the real problem was a lack of representation in Parliament. Britain was still very far from a democracy in the modern sense. Suffrage was restricted to men of property. Religious minorities like Catholics and dissenting Protestants were excluded too. Representation in Parliament was based on medieval districts. More than a third of MPs were elected by fewer than 100 voters, in the so-called rotten boroughs. And Manchester, with more than 100,000 people, was not represented at all. So a movement for parliamentary reform gradually gained momentum. In 1818, the movement amplified its voice with the weekly newspaper, the Manchester Observer, which quickly became one of the leading radical papers in Britain, with a circulation of around 3,000 to 4,000, which was impressive at the time. This worried local magistrates, who reported that the radical meetings and the unbounded liberty of the press were the principal causes of the evil which we apprehend. The government turned to its 101 on responding to political dissent and repeatedly indicted the Observer's chief editor, the radical activist James Rowe, for seditious libel. Twice, he was convicted. The Manchester Observer and the radicals behind it were central to the organization of the enormous public meeting on August 16, 1819, that would go down in history as the Peterloo Massacre. The goal was to call for universal suffrage, although universal in this case only meant all adult males. The organizers took care to organize a non-violent protest within the bounds of the law and invited the radical firebrand orator Henry Hunt to give the keynote speech. When the day of the protest arrived, a massive 60,000 protesters marched into St. Peter's Square in central Manchester, waving their banners and shouting slogans for reform. But the magistrates had convinced themselves that such a large public meeting could only end in riot. Just as Hunt had arrived on the stage, the troops moved in to arrest him. Panic spread among the protesters, and Hunt called out, "Stand firm, my friends. You see they are in disorder already. This is a trick. Give them 3 cheers." But the cheers caused the soldiers to panic. They drew their swords and began to swing at the protesters. In little more than 10 minutes, the field was cleared, leaving behind some 11 dead and more than 400 injured. To add insult to injury, the government prosecuted Hunt and other key players at Peterloo for unlawful assembly and basically fused sedition and public order into a new weapon aimed at preventing organized political protests. But if the authorities had thought that this would be the end of the discussion, they would be severely disappointed. For the Peterloo Massacre became a powerful symbol of oppression for democratic reformers throughout the country, and the radical press increased its circulation immensely. As a government official complained, because of the massacre, odious and blasphemous publications poured forth throughout the country. And even as the government finally succeeded in shutting down the Manchester Observer in 1821, its readers were directed to a new paper founded in the ashes of Peterloo, the paper we know today as The Guardian. The gutting of the Manchester Observer was far from the only reaction from the British government of Lord Liverpool, which was horrified by the growth of the radical press. In the words of Home Secretary Sidmouth, "The most efficient cause of the present critical state of the country was the audacious licentiousness of the press." He responded by a series of regulations known as the Six Acts in 1819. The Six Acts included increasing punishments for seditious libel, limiting freedom of association, and most effectively, raising the stamp duty to a level where newspapers simply became unaffordable to the vast majority of the poor. A good example of what triggered the government was this passage from 1820, which argued that
"The House of Commons was composed of venal borough-mongers, greedy adventurers, and aspiring title-hunters. A body, in short, containing a far greater portion of public criminals than public guardians."
But the cost of letting off such explosive steam was a year behind bars. Since seditious libel prosecutions for political radicalism was like flipping a coin, the government also pulled out another blade from its Swiss Army knife of repression. Since a famous case in 1676, blasphemous libel had been part of the common law, based on the premise that reviling Christianity was not only an offense to God, but a crime against the law, state, and government, since Christianity was the foundation of these institutions. As we've seen, in 1792, Tom Paine had fled England for France, but his ideas could not be quarantined on the other side of the Channel. In Rights of Man, he had savagely attacked the British system of government. With The Age of Reason from 1794, he took aim at the other central pillar of English society, Christianity. And when Paine locked in on his target, he squeezed the trigger and didn't let go before he had run out of Deer's paper bullets. "What is it the Bible teaches us?" he asked, and answered,
rape, cruelty, and murder. What is it the New Testament teaches us? To believe that the Almighty committed debauchery with a woman engaged to be married, and the belief of this debauchery is called faith. And there was more, much, much more of the same kind. So it's no surprise that no other book became so frequently prosecuted for blasphemy in England. Ironically, the prosecutor in one of the first cases was none other than Thomas Erskine, the very lawyer who had defended Paine against a charge of seditious libel with a stirring speech defending the free speech of Englishmen. But to Erskine, attacking the government was one thing, religion another. But 19th century English radicals found much to admire in Paine and deism and their combined 1-2 punch against the conservative pillars of English society, hereditary government and established religion, which justified the discrimination of dissenters and freethinkers and the exclusion of the lower classes from political influence. No one was a more prolific blasphemer than Richard Carlyle, who spent a total of 10 years in prison for speech crimes, 6 for blasphemy. But his years in the slammer were not in vain. According to Leonard Levy, no one in British history achieved more for press freedom than Carlyle, who insisted, "My whole and sole object from first to last has been a free press and free discussion." Carlyle's worst offense was publishing and selling deist publications, not least The Age of Reason, to the lower classes. Carlyle also wrote an account of the Peterloo Massacre and became the most prominent target of the government's 1819 post-Peterloo offensive that resulted in around 75 prosecutions for blasphemous and seditious libel. Carlyle alone faced 9 indictments for blasphemy, not least due to the Society for the Suppression of Vice, which reported irreligious material to the magistrates and lobbied for suppression. In October 1819, Carlyle was tried, and the Attorney General pulled no punches. The Age of Reason was one of the most abominable, disgusting, and wicked attacks on religion that has appeared in the world. But it was not God or religion that needed protection. It was the established order of the British class-based society. According to the Attorney General, prosecuting Carlyle was necessary to
protect the lower and illiterate classes from having their faith sapped and their minds divested from those principles of morality which are so powerfully inculcated by the Christian religion. When such terrible productions are put into the hands of those who, unlike the rich, the informed, and the powerful, are unable to draw distinctions between ingenious, though mischievous, arguments and divine truth, the consequences are too frightful to be contemplated.
It seems Karl Marx was not the only one who thought religion was opium for the masses. The presiding judge refused Carlyle the right to demonstrate inconsistencies of the Bible, since it was against the law to revile Christianity. In other words, Carlyle's case was doomed from the get-go. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison and a fine of £1,500. His printship was raided and all his property confiscated. Then Carlyle himself was imprisoned in solitary confinement, more than 100 miles away from his home in London. But amazingly, Carlyle's wife, sister, and a long line of shopmen kept up his work and continued printing and selling The Age of Reason and other deist publications, despite being met with harassment, stiff prison sentences, and fines. Carlyle's shopmen even founded and published the Newgate Monthly magazine from Newgate Prison. The rough treatment of Carlyle and other radicals prompted serious discussion about the value of a free press. A meticulous, if somewhat dry and dense, contribution was made by a famous philosopher named Mill. James Mill, that is. His 1825 On Liberty of the Press made the case that press freedom extended to both politics and religion. But Mill's most important contribution to free speech was fathering the wunderkind John Stuart Mill. He was taught Greek at the age of 3, Latin at 8, and most of the classical canon and algebra at 12. And at the ripe age of 18, Mill Jr. published an essay on religious persecution, which used the Carlyle case to show that blasphemy prosecutions were both indefensible and counterproductive. Mill estimated that the prosecutions of Carlyle had increased the reach of Paine's Age of Reason with some 20,000 copies and 100,000 readers. If reading deism was safe for the well-educated classes, then the solution was to educate, not prosecute, the lower classes. Let there be no other class than the educated, he wrote. The indefatigable efforts of Carlyle's radicals and the intellectual efforts of Mill and Mill seemed to work. After a string of convictions in 1824, the constant barrage of blasphemous libel prosecutions stopped in 1825 under increasing criticism of the draconian restrictions on freedom of speech, due process, and personal liberty. Deist publications, including The Age of Reason, could suddenly be sold freely. The government had won battle after battle in the courts, but lost the wider war against blasphemy, and as an unintended consequence, entrenched the idea of press freedom extending to both political and religious ideas. In a related development, the movement for parliamentary reform only became stronger in the 1820s, not least through the efforts of the press. As the high Tory Sir Walter Scott, whom you might remember as the author of Ivanhoe, lamented, "The whole daily press seems to me to have embraced democratical opinions without exception." The gradual movement of public opinion towards a more liberal bent was confirmed when a Tory-dominated government removed discrimination of non-Anglican Christians in 1828 and 1829. But in the area of press freedom, real change only came with the 1830 election of a Whig government with a platform of comprehensive reform. Initially, things actually got off on the wrong foot. In the beginning of 1831, three prominent journalists were indicted for seditious libel due to their perceived role in a number of riots that had gripped the countryside the year before. This included, you've guessed it, one Richard Carlyle, who was sentenced to 2 years' imprisonment. But as it turned out, this marked the beginning of the end of seditious libel as an instrument to punish public opinion in Britain, even though the crime was only formally removed in 2009. The following years saw one reform after the other. The Great Reform Act of 1832 got rid of most of the rotten boroughs and substantially expanded the electorate. And most important from the perspective of the press, in 1836 the stamp duty was drastically reduced from 4 pennies down to 1. In 1834, before the reduction, between 25 and 35 million newspapers were distributed annually. This was already a huge number compared with anywhere else in the world, and had led King William IV to describe England as this unfortunately press-ridden country. But 2 years later, the number had doubled, and by 1850, total sales reached almost 100 million. This massive growth was aided by the rapid mechanization of the press in the 1830s and 40s. In 1848, John Stuart Mill concluded that the working classes had decidedly thrown off the yoke of patriarchal or paternal system of government
when they were taught to read and allowed access to newspapers and political tracts, when dissenting preachers were suffered to go among them and appeal to their faculties and feelings in opposition to the creeds professed and countenanced by their superiors, when they were encouraged to seek a share in the government.
Free speech had been secured more by practice than by principle. And in Britain, the freedom of the press had come to stay. Despite the public disturbances associated with the Chartist movement that called for even further democratic reform in the 1830s and 40s, the liberties of the radical press were not substantially infringed upon, as the government tended to crack down on threats to public order rather than dangerous ideas. So in 1859, John Stuart Mill could open one of the most famous chapters in the history of political liberalism on a positive note.
The time, it is to be hoped, is gone by when any defense would be necessary of the liberty of the press as one of the securities against corrupt or tyrannical government. No argument, we may suppose, can now be needed against permitting a legislature or an executive not identified in the interest with the people to prescribe opinions to them and determine what doctrines or what arguments they shall be allowed to hear.
Chapter 2 in Mill's On Liberty is hailed by many as the foundational text on why free speech matters. though as I hope you've noticed, many of Mill's arguments had been made much earlier, as he himself admitted. This includes his famous dictum that restricting free speech prevents people from enjoying the great benefit of exchanging error for truth, as well as the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. We find traces of this idea all the way back to Demosthenes in ancient Athens, and we have a very clear precedent in Elie Lussac's Defense of Atheist Publications from 1749. But the forcefulness of Mill's argument is undeniable. Take this quote.
If all mankind minus one were of one opinion, and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind.
Or this encouragement of intellectual humility to the partisans of orthodoxy, whether religious or secular.
We can never be sure that the opinion we are endeavoring to stifle is a false opinion, and if we were sure, stifling it would be an evil still.
I cannot do justice to the content and influence of Mill's ideas in this episode, but will strongly consider a separate expert opinion only on Mill. Suffice to say, for now, that On Liberty played an important role in shaping public opinion, but also in persuading an American Supreme Court justice to adopt the course of free expression in the early 20th century, out of which would crystallize the idea that content-based restrictions on speech require a clear and present danger. From across the channel, Britain must have seemed like a paradise of tolerance and free debate, even at the height of Tory repression. The mood among continental European hardliners was best expressed by Austria's top diplomat and secretary to the Congress of Vienna, Friedrich von Gentz.
As a preventive measure against the abuses of the press, absolutely nothing should be printed for years. With this maxim as a rule, we should in a short time get back to God and the truth.
Other European states realized that putting a complete halt to all printing presses would be unrealistic. But the Congress did commit the member states of the new German Confederation, which included Austria and Prussia, to adopt a common press law. Still, to the deep regret of the powerful Austrian Chancellor Clemens von Metternich, who believed press freedom to be the scourge of the world, several German states actually adopted press laws that mentioned press freedom. But luckily for Metternich, in 1819, a conservative publicist was assassinated by a German nationalist. Metternich wasted no time in seizing the moment, and with the aid of Prussia, he succeeded in finally establishing a common press law for all German states under the notorious Carlsbad Decrees, aimed at combating nationalists and liberals. Not only did the Carlsbad Decrees centralize German pre-publication censorship, they also severely restricted academic freedom. Teachers and students at universities could lose their jobs and enrollment if they expressed subversive or immoral opinions. And students who were part of nationalist organizations could forget about public employment. Then there was the Investigative Commission, a modern secular inquisition vested with sniffing out revolutionary machinations across the Confederation. In short, German censorship had never been more effective. Metternich and his like-minded colleagues across Europe saw the reintroduction of censorship as a necessary tool to guarantee social order, or in the words of a leading French conservative, Vicomte de Bonnel, a sanitary precaution to protect society from the contagion of false doctrines, just like measures to prevent the spread of the plague. In France, this sanitary precaution came in the form of the new press law of 1814, which required all publications, printers, and booksellers to obtain royal sanction from the newly restored monarchy. In 1832, Pope Gregory XVI, who was both head of the Catholic Church and the Papal States, issued a long and rambling encyclical on liberalism. Gregory thundered against that absurd and erroneous proposition which claims that liberty of conscience must be maintained for everyone, as well as the evil of immoderate freedom of opinion license of free speech, and desire for novelty. He took aim at that harmful and never sufficiently denounced freedom to publish any writings whatever and disseminate them to the people. The potential victims of this metaphorical plague that most worried church and state were not only radical intellectuals, but increasingly also the lower classes. This was a problem arising from the massive increase in literacy in Europe. By the 1840s, as many as 90% of Scandinavians could read and write due to public schools. In Britain and German states, literacy rates had climbed to 75%, and in France and Belgium, upwards of 60% of the adult population was literate. The spread of literacy meant that a far larger group of people than earlier had the opportunity to participate in public discussions, previously reserved for the uppermost elite. A reactionary French newspaper in 1829 declared,
"The rage to read has invaded everywhere. Reading has now reached the blacksmith's shop, the quarries, the sheds of woodjoiner's apprentices, and the stonemason's closet under the stairs."
The fact that the lower classes were clustered together in cities due to rapid urbanization made rulers even more fearful. Because if the lower classes were seduced by the wrong publications, they could mobilize and riot, leading to revolutions. As we've already seen, an effective way of keeping newspapers out of the hands of the poor were the various stamp taxes in place in most European states. You might also add expensive licensing requirement for newspaper ownership so that printing presses were also off limits to the lower classes. The focus on the lower classes of European censorship was also evident from the different way various kinds of media were treated. In both France, Germany, and Russia, long books were exempted from pre-publication censorship as these were thought to be only read by scholars and not the general population. Among the scholarly works given the thumbs up by Tsarist Russia in the 1870s was Karl Marx's Das Kapital. Surely no one would read anything so dry and boring. Well, that didn't work out so well. At the other end of the spectrum, drawings and theater were seen as especially dangerous, as even the illiterate could understand a play or a caricature, and therefore they remained subject to prior censorship long after it had been lifted from the press more generally. But even with the combined power of autocratic regimes throughout the European continent, try as they might, they couldn't put the liberal genie back in the bottle. One of the most forceful refutations of the reactionary backlash against free speech was written by the French politician and political theorist Benjamin Constant. He had been charged with drafting a new and more liberal constitution by Napoleon when he had made a short and ill-fated comeback in 1815, his 100 days. As part of that process, Constant wrote Principles of Politics Applicable to All Governments, published in 1815. Which I think includes one of the most important but underrated contributions to the free speech doctrine of its time. Constant came to the opposite conclusion of the prevailing conservative wisdom of the day. It was not press freedom that had led to the French Revolution and its horrors. It was in fact the systematic denial of press freedom which had allowed the French state and its finances to degenerate and its abuses to go unchecked that were the chief causes of the revolution. Moreover, censorship and repression had made the French people credulous, anxious, and ignorant, so that once given freedom, they did not know the real value and meaning of this concept suddenly thrust upon them. As we've seen, the French philosophes had done little in terms of creating a viable and consistent theory of free speech. But Constant argued that this freedom not only is the guardian of all civil and political liberty, but also that
today, to restrain the freedom of the press is to restrain the human race's intellectual freedom. The press is an instrument such freedom can no longer do without. Printing has made the sole means of publicizing things the only mode of communication between nations as much as between individuals. By the nature and extent of our modern societies, and by the abolition of all the popular and disorderly ways of doing this, this question of press freedom is therefore the general one about the development of the human mind.
Constant saw clearly that governments wielding a monopoly on the press becomes a clear and present danger to its population due to what today we would call one-sided state-sponsored propaganda. As we've also seen, the concept of calumny had been expanded to protect ideas, institutions, and the government with deadly consequences during the revolution. So Constant limited the applicability of calumny to the protection of the honor and interest of individuals. Now, he did not deny that press freedom could result in danger and inconvenience, but he argued that the advantages of a free press far surpassed the uncertain gains of censorship, which would always be liable to abuse. Consequently, limits on free speech had to be narrow, and, following Montesquieu, he put emphasis on deeds rather than words.
Writing, like speech, like the most simple movements, can be part of an action. They must be judged as part of that action if it is criminal. But if they do not constitute part of any action, they must, like speech, enjoy complete freedom.
Constant's ideas wielded influence among liberals both in and outside France. The first cracks in the reactionary armor appeared in France in 1822. French liberals succeeded in pressuring the government to give up prior censorship. Through the 1820s, the French state shifted between tightening censorship and then loosening it again, when the resulting public outrage became too much to bear. Then, in 1830, after parliamentary elections had resulted in a victory for critics hostile to the regime, King Charles X finally decided to settle the matter by dissolving parliament and ramping up repression. And as always, press freedom was first in the firing line. In the years leading up to 1830, the liberal press had exploded in popularity in Paris, reaching a combined circulation of 50,000. Almost four times that of its more conservative rivals. This level of popularity horrified Charles, who blamed the press for destabilizing government, depressing the army, and subverting religion. With a series of four emergency laws, Charles completely suspended press freedom and tried to silence all liberal newspapers by seizing their presses and arresting their editors. But instead of an end to his problems, Charles found himself with a revolution on his hands. Journalists and printers refused to comply with the emergency laws, bolted the doors of their print shops, and began printing calls for resistance. The working people of Paris heeded their calls. In what has since come to be a symbol of revolution itself, put up barricades in the streets. Within three glorious days, as the revolution is known as in French, the king had been deposed and power was in the hands of a provisional government ruled by liberals. The new declaration declared that all Frenchmen have the right to publish and have printed their views in conformity with the law. Censorship will never be re-established. The 1830 revolution sent waves of joy and relief to embattled liberals throughout the Western world. Could the long conservative winter finally be thawing? Famous young reformers flocked to France, such as the British philosopher John Stuart Mill and the German journalist and poet Heinrich Heine, both of whom would play a critical role for the idea and practice of free speech. The revolutionary reports coming out of Paris from people like Heine also had repercussions in Germany. Popular unrest swelled, and several German states were pressured into creating constitutions. In the small state of Baden, a powerful reform movement succeeded in passing a libertarian press law that removed all censorship of the press. Its leader, Karl von Rotteck, wrote,
"That a free press assure certain victory for truth and justice without force, solely through the divine judgment of unfettered public opinion, through the directing authority of human reason."
Everywhere, associations working toward freedom of the press emerged, culminating in a large public demonstration in Hambach in 1832, where national liberals denounced the German government and called for freedom of the press to an audience of more than 30,000 people. But the powerful Prussian and Austrian rulers could not let the scourge of re-enlightenment gain a foothold in Germany, and so reaction was swift. Already in 1832, the German Confederation passed the so-called Six Acts and Ten Articles, which forced individual states to enforce censorship. It held that the limits of free expression cannot be exceeded in a manner that endangers the peace of an individual confederal state or that of Germany as a whole. The rainbow and unicorn liberals of Baden were not only forced to retract their permissive press law. Its author, von Rotteck, was put on a list of suspected subversives, and more than 2,000 people were investigated throughout Germany. Then, in 1835, followed a full-scale ban on all works by a number of writers called the Young Germans, including Heinrich Heine. He had famously and prophetically said that, where books are burned, there in the end will men be burned too. And Heine had also shown his disdain for censorship in a poem titled The German Censors. It consisted of that very title, followed by several lines of censorial redactions, with just one word remaining, idiots. Back in France, the high hopes for a liberal government also went up in flames. The newly crowned constitutional monarch Louis-Philippe grew increasingly annoyed at the critical press and stinging caricatures that popped up everywhere. Only a couple of months after the revolution, the first exceptions to freedom of speech were introduced, and over the following years, censorship was gradually reimposed. John Stuart Mill quickly became more and more disillusioned with what happened in France he felt was turning into a moneyed and corrupt oligarchy. Then in 1835, the notorious September Laws imposed a heavy system of controls of the political press. Caricatures were outright banned, and so was the use of the word republic. Heavy financial obligations were also put on newspapers. A leading writer commented,
"During the French Revolution, one cut journalists' heads. Under Napoleon, one silenced them. Under the Restoration, one jailed them. Under the July Monarchy, one ruined them financially."
And another writer simply termed the September Laws a reign of terror for ideas. In the span of a couple of years, the liberal dream had died, and the European continent was yet again under the thumb of the censors. Following the 1830 revolution, the governments of Europe held the press in a tight rein. Generally, the further east you got, the more oppressive the regime. In Russia, a huge apparatus of more than 12 different censorship units placed almost comically strict limits on what could be published and imported. Subversive materials included such things as the fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen and a cooking book referring to the revolutionary-sounding Free Air in an Oven. Further west, in the Austrian Empire, things were not much better, and Austria was dubbed the China of Europe. The pamphlet flood during the enlightened despot Joseph II had long since dried out. In the 13 years between 1835 and 1848, at least 5,000 book titles were banned by the censors, with the quickly growing index of forbidden books being compared to a catalogue of masterpieces of European literature. At the top of the bureaucratic layer of Austrian censorship stood our old friend Metternich, who saw the press as the most urgent evil and intellectuals as craven. "If only we could have knowledge without scholars," he once sighed. If things were better in other parts of the German lands, it was mostly because the central coordination of censorship under the Carlsbad decrees was unable to root out all offending material. German writers often dodged the censors by crossing the many state borders. Newspaper articles and books censored in Hamburg, for example, were often simply published in the Danish-administered state of Holstein and swiftly reimported. Another problem was the immense growth of published literature. Between 1830 and 1846, the number of books doubled from 7,000 per year to almost 14,000. Faced with such growth, the German censors were often buried in work. But things were not easy for writers of a liberal or even radical inclination. After his reporting on the 1830 revolution, Heinrich Heine remained exiled in Paris. In the 1840s, he befriended another German writer exiled to Paris because of censorship, the young revolutionary Karl Marx. Due to the, shall we say, spotty free speech record of socialist countries, few now realized that Marx was a vocal defender of press freedom. In 1842, at the age of 24, Marx kick-started his career by writing a series of articles for the newly established reformist paper, the Rheinische Zeitung, published in Prussia. According to Marx, state censorship was ruinous for intellectual efforts, and he wrote,
"The free press is the ubiquitous vigilant eye of a people's soul, the embodiment of a people's faith in itself, the eloquent link that connects the individual with the state and the world, the embodied culture that transforms material struggles into intellectual struggles and idealizes their crude material form. It is a people's frank confession to itself. It is the spiritual mirror in which a people can see itself, and self-examination is the first condition of wisdom."
Heady stuff. Marx quickly became the editor of the Rheinische Zeitung, and radicalized its editorial line. The growing fame of Marx's writings inevitably attracted the censors as well, and they tightened their screws further until they finally forced the paper to shut down in March 1843. The specific reason was a personal request by the Russian Tsar to suppress the paper, as he felt some articles had been too critical of the Tsarist regime. Faced by the growing seal of the censors, Marx went into exile in Paris, where he continued to write in the company of Heine. But less than 2 years later, this time at the request of Prussian officials, he got himself deported to Brussels, where he had to swear not to write or do anything political, a promise he immediately broke. In the course of the following 4 years, with the censors constantly looking over his shoulders, Marx would see himself back in Germany, then Paris again, until he finally ended up in the last refuge of European writers, London. One of the interesting aspects of Marx's story is the way that European governments work together to enforce their censorship. We used to think of the European state system of the time as a collection of mutually hostile governments competing viciously. But in the area of censorship, we see how conservative governments work together to weave a dense network of repression throughout the continent, hoping to catch reformist writers even as they jumped across borders. The arm of the law was long indeed. Throughout the 1830s and early 40s, this European network of repression mostly succeeded in keeping liberal ideas at bay. But the continuous growth in literacy rates and publications, along with the disruption caused by the emerging industrialization of Europe, meant that popular discontentment increasingly acted like a pressure cooker, ready to burst at any moment. And in the spring of 1848, the whole thing finally exploded. As always, the fuse was lit in Paris. Here, the growing disillusionment with the July monarchy, established after the last revolution, found its expression in the so-called banquet campaign. Freedom of assembly was suppressed, so instead, a series of public banquets were held, which were thinly disguised political meetings. When the French government responded by forbidding the banquets, all hell broke loose. People flooded into the streets, erected the obligatory barricades, and in a matter of days forced King Louis-Philippe to abdicate and go into exile. In his place, a second French Republic was declared, asserting that the Republic lives by liberty and discussion. The Republican leadership immediately abolished censorship and instituted universal male suffrage. In a matter of weeks, the revolution spread like wildfire through the European continent in what has become known as the Springtime of the Peoples. A number of small German states were the first to fall. Only 3 days after the demise of the French monarchy, the Grand Duke of notoriously liberal Baden granted his subjects press freedom. 2 days later, the entire Carlsbad system of federal censorship controls was demolished. In the electorate of Hesse-Kassel, the police chief responded to demonstrators clamoring for press freedom by shouting, "Yes, just write, everything you write will be printed." By the end of March, censorship had fallen throughout Germany, and the conservative powers were in fast retreat. In March in Denmark, popular demonstrations organized in part by the Society for the Proper Use of Freedom of the Press also brought censorship to a halt and resulted in the establishment of a democracy there. In Austria-Hungary, a popular uprising forced Metternich to flee into exile and similarly ended restrictions of the press. The only major powers that escaped the revolution was the already comparatively liberal Great Britain and the extremely repressive Russian Empire. Though 6 decades later, revolutionary ideas would be back with a vengeance. The collapse of censorship in Western and Central Europe resulted in an explosion of political journalism. In Germany, the number of different newspapers doubled almost overnight. In Paris, the combined circulation of newspapers jumped from 50 to 400,000 by the end of May. In Vienna, the 19 newspapers permitted to discuss politics under the previous regime suddenly had to compete with 287 new publications. But the substance of political journalism changed as much as the quantity. Traditionally, publications had been written in a dense style and aimed at a well-educated audience. But now, a number of working man's papers entered the scene, helped by the gradual introduction of the steam press in the 1840s. newspapers were on the way to becoming the first truly mass media in history. Unfortunately, the onwards march of history rarely follows a straight line, and fall soon followed springtime. For all the hope inspired by the 1848 revolutions, the pendulum quickly swung back towards autocracy and repression. Already in August of the same year, the Republican regime in France began reintroducing mild forms of press controls. This included state registration and forced security deposits. Then in December, perhaps not having read up on their Republican history, the French population elected Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte, nephew of the original Napoleon, as the first president of the Republic of France. Louis had won the election by spearheading a new form of politics that we are only too familiar with in our present era, populism. Helped by his famous last name, Louis presented himself as a political outsider transcending the political spectrum of left and right. Untainted by the corrupt politics of the previous era, Louis could both defend traditional morals and campaign on social issues such as poverty and unemployment. This cocktail earned him the support of the newly enfranchised mass of poor but culturally conservative peasants, and consequently more than 70% of the vote. But to his contemporaries in high society France, Louis did not strike a grand figure and was often the subject of public ridicule. So shortly after his election, he began a harassment campaign against the liberal press using a template familiar to the Erdogans, Putins and Duertes of the 21st century. He prohibited insulting the president and maliciously affirming erroneous facts likely to disturb the peace, i.e. fake news. In the following 2 years, Louis gradually tightened the screws until in December 1851, he finally let his mask drop and mounted a coup d'etat. The last remains of the free press were suppressed when Louis proclaimed himself Napoleon III, Emperor of France, and buried the Second Republic and democracy with it. The radical idea and practice of a free press did not survive for long in Germany and the Austrian Empire either. In Vienna, the revolutionaries were defeated by October 1848, and censorship slowly crept back. By 1852, a new press decree banned all writings
of an orientation that was hostile to the throne, the monarchy, the unity and integrity of the empire, monarchical principles, religion, public morals, or the overall foundations of the state society, or of an orientation that was incompatible with the maintenance of public law and order.
Or in essence, anything that the new government didn't like. Consequently, the number of publications fell to less than a third at what it had been in the high point of the revolution. In Prussia and the rest of the German lands, the return of censorship followed the same track as in Austria. Prior censorship was never reinstated, but a repressive post-publication regime was back in place everywhere by the early 1850s. In the view of the governments, time had simply moved beyond prior censorship as an effective way of controlling public discourse, not least due to the constant growth in the number of publications, which made prior censorship ever more difficult and expensive. As a Russian censor complained, the workload had reached such incredible dimensions that the poor clerks got calluses on their hands. So instead of spending massive resources on sifting through all written material, it was more effective to outsource the task to the publishers and writers themselves. With the constant threat of government repression, publishers were intimidated into self-censorship. It was only on the edges of the European great powers that the gains of the 1848 revolution were substantially held on to. In the northwestern Italian state of Piedmont, whose king had established a constitution protecting freedom of press in 1848, the press remained largely free. As Piedmont came to be the only place in Italy where ideas could be discussed freely, thousands of exiles from other Italian states, including many writers and political thinkers, flocked to its capital, Turin. The city quickly became the center of the growing political movement to unify Italy and shape it into a modern constitutional nation-state, which was achieved just over a decade later. In this case, far from being a danger to the state, freedom of the press had become one of the main reasons for its later success. But still, free speech was far from sacred. In 1898, social and political unrest led to a bloody crackdown on protesters and the arbitrary suppression of some 100 newspapers. In Denmark, the democracy established in 1849 would prove more resilient. The German doctor and usurper Struensee had been a trailblazer when he abolished all censorship in 1770, as we saw in episode 30. But though almost all the founding fathers of the Danish constitution had been convicted for violating press freedom laws, the Danish constitution of 1849 was very modest and conservative. It only abolished pre-publication censorship, but provided no protection against post-publication penalties or restrictions. It was essentially a Blackstonian model of free speech, implemented more than 150 years after pre-publication had been abolished in England, and it provided scant protection when the nascent socialist movement was persecuted by democratically elected governments in the 1870s. Outside of the few pockets of relatively free speech on the European continent, repression continued for a quarter of a century following 1848. The newly restored French imperial government was among the harshest censors. The countless restrictive laws passed in the time after the coup of Napoleon III created a veritable judicial maze of regulation. At least 6 different handbooks were published to guide both censors and journalists through the Kafkaesque red lines. Hundreds of prosecutions were brought against publishers and writers, and more than 60 newspapers suppressed or suspended, along with countless books, pamphlets, plays, and more. In France, there's only one journalist, and that is the emperor, complained the liberal parliamentarian Jules Favre. A brief respite from censorship occurred in the chaotic year of 1870, where a catastrophic military defeat at the hands of Bismarck caused the imperial regime to collapse, and censorship with it. On top of this came the proclamation in 1871 of a socialist commune in Paris. But the communards were quickly crushed, and the new Third Republic reimposed censorship once again and enforced it even more harshly than under the empire. In the closely contested election of 1877, this reached epic proportion, as more than 2,500 prosecutions were brought against the press in the span of only 6 months. Despite the massive crackdown, victory in the 1877 elections were won by liberal factions, who now targeted the conservative papers. But this game of back-and-forth oppression did not continue for long. In 1881, the liberal government issued a new press law, which essentially freed the press from censorship, except in marginal cases. France had again, for the fourth time in a century, established freedom of the press. And this time, it was here to stay. The liberal nature of the 1881 law is underscored by the resulting boom in publications. In the following decade, the number of newspapers in France rose from 3,800 to 6,000. And the period from 1881 until 1914 saw a golden age for the press, with the total circulation of newspapers exploding from some 100,000 to more than 5 million. And the press law of 1881 still formed the basis of France's current press law, though quite a few exceptions have been added over time. Events in Germany took a broadly similar course, though with a somewhat less liberal endpoint. Even though prior censorship was never reintroduced into any German states after 1848, a repressive apparatus of post-publication censorship continued. And cooperation between the different states was strengthened by the creation of a secret pan-German police association in 1851, which coordinated repression of publications deemed dangerous to the state. And it worked. An 1854 report happily concluded.
A revolutionary press, as it was to be found in 1848 and to a degree still in 1849 in Germany, no longer exists. In the whole of Germany at this time, there is not a single newspaper that would dare to preach open revolt.
This state of affairs continued almost unchanged for 20 years, until the Iron Chancellor Otto von Bismarck created a unified German Empire under Prussian dominance in 1871. And in Bismarck's unified Germany, controls on the press were actually substantially reduced, at least formally. The Imperial Press Law of 1874 removed all licensing requirements for publishers and has been described as a significant liberal achievement. But there were limits. It was a crime to create or spread fake news, defined as to knowingly fabricate or distort facts in order to incite in others contempt for state institutions or the law, as well as to slander or libel officials, clergymen, or members of the armed forces who were carrying out their professional duties. This created ample room for the government to clamp down on troublemakers. In fact, in the 3 years following the law, no less than 2,500 legal charges were brought against the press by the imperial state. And there is a reason why Bismarck was called the Iron Chancellor. And that did not include being soft on political dissent that might challenge the prevailing order. By the 1870s, the German Social Democratic Party was fast becoming popular enough to be seen as a threat by Bismarck. The socialists represented the worst fear of the old conservative guard, an organized working class taking active part in society with crazy ideas about abolishing private property and upending the social order. To Bismarck, the Social Democratic Party was an enemy against whom the state and society are bound to defend themselves. And as the old saying goes, the best defense is a good offense. Now, any good politician knows that timing is everything. And the perfect time for repressive laws are periods of crisis when fear and panic call for decisive action. So when Emperor Wilhelm I was twice the target of failed assassination attempts, Bismarck was ready to pounce. In 1878, Bismarck forced through an anti-socialist law. It allowed the government to summarily ban and punish any organization, publication, or other activity in which
social democratic, socialistic, or communistic endeavors aiming at the overthrow of the existing political or social order are manifested in a manner dangerous to the public peace and particularly to harmony among the classes of the population.
In less than 2 months, the socialist press was essentially gone. Over the following 12 years, no less than 1,300 publications were banned, more than 100 associations disbanded, and countless works of art of socialist influence prohibited. In 1880, the socialist leader August Bebel complained of the white terror, including house searches of anyone who is even remotely suspected of having anything to do with a banned paper or with people partial to them. From the passage of the press law and until Bismarck's resignation in 1890, there were at least 3,287 press trials covering 5,975 separate offenses. Astonishingly, libels of Bismarck alone made up more than 60% of those cases. Turkey's Erdogan would surely be jealous. And things were not much better in neighboring Austria, where the government instituted over 2,000 prosecutions and confiscations of newspapers between 1877 and 1880. But even after 1890, with Bismarck gone and the anti-socialist law finally lapsed, the Social Democrats were still severely repressed. Countless charges of incitement to contempt of the social order were leveled against socialist writers and publishers. The socialist press took up the fight. In 1910, the Hamburger Echo wrote,
"In waging our war, we do not throw bombs. Instead, we throw our newspapers amongst the masses of the working people. Printing ink is our explosive."
But the socialists controlled neither the means of production nor the monopoly on the use of force. So in the first half of 1913 alone, 104 social democratic journalists were convicted to a combined 40 years of prison and crippling fines. As one historian put it, every day of the year saw one person convicted for press-related offenses. In short, while the liberal press saw improvements in their relative freedom in the last half of the 19th century, the German state recognized a new and even more dangerous enemy had entered the stage from the left. And all the way up to the end of the First World War, the full arsenal of repression was put to the task of suppressing this new enemy, for whom freedom of the press remained only a dream. The German press law also prohibited blasphemy and obscenity, though these categories were less frequently enforced than the draconian laws against socialists. But one case of blasphemy is worth highlighting. In 1894, the German playwright Oskar Panizza was sentenced to a year in prison for his highly provocative play Das Liebenkanzel, which mocks central figures of Christianity, including Jesus, Mary, and God himself. Fast forward 100 years, and the European Court of Human Rights had to decide whether the police in Austria had violated free speech by seizing a modern film version of Das Liebenkanzel shown in a private art cinema. In a decision which still remains a binding precedent, the top European Human Rights Court decided that Austrian authorities had not violated free speech, as the film was gratuitously offensive to the religious feelings of Catholics and did not contribute to any form of political debate capable of furthering progress in human affairs. Most perniciously, the court decided that the protection of freedom of religion required certain limits on the exercise of freedom of expression. In other words, had Oskar Panizza been able to bring his case before the European Court of Human Rights today, he would not have won on the merits, though the court would likely have found the punishment too harsh. Despite the dramatic backlash of the early 19th century and the back and forth between liberal reforms and reactionary crackdowns, free speech, and especially press freedom, had come to stay at the end of the century and the beginning of the new one. Pre-publication censorship was all but dead, and the public sphere gave room to much more diverse points of view than when the likes of Metternich was in charge. In 1912, the great British 20th century historian J.B. Burry summed up the state of freedom of thought.
At present, in most civilized countries, freedom of speech is taken as a matter of course and seems a perfectly simple thing. We are so accustomed to it that we look on it as a natural right. But this right has been acquired only in recent times, and the way to its attainment has lain through lakes of blood.
But a mere 2 years later, and a century after the Congress of Vienna, the Great War would result in new lakes of blood, deeper than at any other point in previous human history, as well as massive repression of dissent, censorship, and surveillance of global communications. The emergence of totalitarian ideologies, another cataclysmic world war, immediately followed by a cold one, created new bloodshed and repression, dashing Burry's hope of free speech continuing its victory march uninhibited in the 20th century. Thank you so much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stæhøj, and invaluable research was made by Lars Emil Nissen.